Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, books turned into films, and with us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Petra Mayer, editor at NPR Books. Hi, Petra.
Hi, happy to be here.
Great. And, you know, we've got lots of material to choose from, and I think a lot of times it might be you're disappointed with maybe the film version of the book. The book usually has more, but sometimes it can be the other way around. So I'm really anxious to see what you brought this morning, or what you have in front of you, I should say. Jill?
Well, I just have to say there are so many potential choices when you start looking. We have this reference book called Video Hound's Golden Movie Retriever, and they have all these different ways that they index films. And one of their indexes is books to film. And it goes on for pages and pages and pages. It starts at Louisa May Alcott and goes to Emile Zola. And Little Women, for example, just to give you an idea of how many possibilities there are to talk about when you're talking about books into film, Little Women, there were 5 versions of Little Women. There were 3 versions of Little Men made. And I suspect, and I have to say, I've only seen 2 of the 5 versions of Little Women, one being with the Katharine Hepburn one playing Jo, which I adore. But then I have to say, the newest version of Little Women was also really great in a completely different way. Dickens has a whole column in this book, Henry James. There are 3 versions of The Turn of the Screw, 6 versions of Les Miserables. I mean, it goes on and on. So Petra and I had no, and this is not with the even looking at what has been made on television. So
right.
I think, Petra, you probably had an equally hard time picking out just a few to talk about.
Yeah, honestly, and I don't even have a reference work. That's a handy thing to have, my gosh. Although, yeah, it's interesting. I tend to stick, when I was thinking about this, to TV adaptations, just because the idea of thinking about movie adaptations of books has made my brain break slightly. But I'd be interested to see what your reference work says about Pride and Prejudice, because, of course, that was the first thing that came to my mind, is the truly epic 1995 TV adaptation with Colin Firth and Jennifer Ely, which, of course,
right.
immortal classic.
Which we all remember fondly.
Yeah. That's, the other thing I was thinking about, right now is just comfort viewing. And there's so many good things right now that are on TV, because everybody sort of just needs an escape. And it's funny that you mentioned Bridgerton, which just dominated the discourse for so long. It's very interesting that, you talked about how if you liked the book or you didn't like the adaptation, or you liked the adaptation, you didn't like the book. I come at Bridgerton from a perspective probably not a lot of other people have, which is that I'm a gigantic romance fan, and so I was watching this with an eye towards, like, is this a romance? Is it respecting all the tropes that I'm expecting? And I liked it as a soap, but for me it didn't work as a romance. Because, of course, a romance has to have a happy ending. And Bridgerton has so many subplots where terrible things happen, which, by the way, some of those aren't in the book. So I'm all in favor of romance on TV. I really hope this starts a trend. But it also made me notice, in terms of translating things to the screen, how many, like, classic romance tropes don't quite work on screen, especially in Bridgerton, because you have Lady Whistledown narrating everything, so you don't get to hear how the characters are thinking about what they're doing. And so sort of the idea of, like, my father was terrible, so I will spite him and never have children, works much better when you could hear what he's actually thinking on the inside. And honestly, I don't know if you guys watched it, but you might have noticed there are a lot of bee motifs, and at the end there's a shot of a bee that's a reference to a plot, major plot in book 2.
I missed that. Well, I did not read the books, though, either. I've only watched this.
They're, if you like romance, they're classic, sort of not quite old school. The series has started about 20 years ago, so it's not on the cutting edge of modern romance, but they're just delightful. I highly
I'll
recommend
them.
I'll
have to check it out. Yeah, watching the Netflix series on it, though, it was a nice distraction, which we're all looking for right now. So I was sorry that was the end of it. We have to wait for, the next season.
Oh, or you can read the books.
Yeah, I can read the books, and then I'll have a hint into what's coming. Yeah.
And the other thing I have to say about the Bridgerton books is that I actually started listening to them, and there is the narrator of the e-books, the audiobooks, is great. Her name's Rosalind Landor, and she has this beautiful British accent, and it just was delightful to listen to them as well as to watch them or read them, as the case may be.
Good to know.
I should check that out. One of the things the pandemic has done to me is it's made it very hard to read a lot of the time, but I'm much more interested in listening to things. Like, I never liked being read to, listening to ebooks or listening to audiobooks or listening to podcasts, and now I'm just like, keep me company while I wander around my neighborhood.
Yeah, there you go. All right, Jill, what's your first book?
What I've brought along, because I feel that we owe a great debt to this particular show, is a celebration of 25 years of outstanding television masterpiece theater. And I have to say, there are so many books that I ended up reading because I first saw them on Masterpiece Theater. I know this is 25 years. They're now celebrating 50 years of outstanding television, so there's even more to look at. The book just reminds you, if you have seen any of these earlier shows, of what a great, great show Masterpiece Theater has been. I particularly loved, although it is a very dark series in so many ways, The Jewel and the Crown, which was based on the novels. They describe what happened when this show was on. I mean, everybody was watching the show at one point, and that was before you could watch it, you know, at your time schedule. This was still when you had to watch it at, you know, the TV's time schedule. And it says in this book, no one enjoys watching the decline and fall of the British Empire as much as the British, and no one pictures it better. They are particularly skilled at taking the dark chapters of their history and turning them into great entertainment. That is precisely what Granada Television did with The Jewel and the Crown, a tour de force that never stopped sparkling on the air and in our hearts and memories. As it had in Britain earlier in the year, it held viewers hostage for 4 months when it was shown on Masterpiece Theater in 14 stunning episodes. And they go on to say it dwarfs all other television series in its visual scope as well as in the richness of its characters. And it was all based on Paul Scott's The Raj Quartet. So, of course, once you have seen The Jewel and Crown, which is true of a lot, you know, sometimes it's interesting, depending on which way you go, if you see the film first or if you read the book first, how strongly you feel about one or the other. And in this case, I have to say they were equally great. I really enjoyed the books, but I would never probably have picked them up had it not been for The Jewel and the Crown, the television series, which is, of course, available on DVD and streaming, I'm sure. It was an amazing series. And again, Masterpiece Theater just did so much great theater and had such great actors. Jeremy Irons was one of their first actors. Susan Hampshire was in a whole bunch of stuff. So I highly recommend The Jewel and the Crown, but also taking a look at the Masterpiece Theater celebration of 25 years of outstanding television.
Sounds good. All right, Petra.
I also want to say, if you are a Masterpiece Theater fan and you want something a little bit lighter, you know, there's always Jeeves and Wooster. I'm so surprised by how many people don't know Hugh Laurie was ever funny. And this is where I met him, right? With Stephen Fry in the Jeeves and Wooster. That actually led to me in high school picking up some of those books. So if you don't want to watch The Decline and Fall of the British Empire, that's another alternative. One of the book to TV adaptations that's my absolute favorite, The Magicians on Sci-Fi Network, which is an adaptation of the Lev Grossman trilogy. It's interesting. I didn't like the books at first because the main character is just so unlikable. Basically what they are, I interviewed Lev Grossman once and then got his take on it and went, oh, okay, you're making sense now. They're kind of his idea about what happens to the magical chosen child, the Harry Potter figure, once they grow up and they age out of sort of Dumbledore's mentorship and they're out in the world and they have to deal with life. And it's sort of a hybrid of that and also a little bit of Narnia. It's about there's a magical school in it and there's a magical land and there's a group of characters who sort of have to deal with all kinds of threats as they grow up and age out of school and have to deal with what's going on in this magical land that's called Fillory. So the idea is kind of like, what would Narnia be like also if Aslan was just an absent-minded jerk? and you got there and all of your illusions about this magical land were suddenly just the scales fall from your eyes and you realize it's actually a fairly difficult place to be. And what I loved about it is that the books certainly are compelling. The main character, like I said, is very unlikable throughout most of them. The series diverges wildly from the books after season one, and it just gets so much richer and broader, and it becomes a true ensemble piece to the point where there's a decision, there's a real dramatic decision at the end of season four that you think is just going to take the show, and it totally doesn't. So what I love about it is essentially a chronicle of just terrible things happening, of like mistakes and betrayals and bad choices and unforeseeable disasters and just things getting worse and worse and worse and worse for our characters. And you just think it's going to be unbearable to watch, but it has such a sly humor and the dialogue is so snappy. And there are musical episodes, which you think would work, but they're utterly delightful. So that is The Magicians on Sci-Fi. It just wrapped up, I think, last year. There's five seasons of it. And it is a really great example of how a TV adaptation can build on what the book gives it and just take the story to a much more interesting place.
I'll have to check that out. I have not heard of that one. Okay, I got to check that one out. Wait,
so good. It's so good. I'm about to rewatch it, actually. That's how good it is.
Oh, okay, great. I'm writing that one down. Joe.
There is an endless array of Sherlock Holmes films, and
of course, yeah.
And he has been transformed into so many different versions of Holmes, and it's really interesting to see, depending again, sort of on which Holmes you started with, as to which Holmes you really like. And I remember being a kid watching on television the Basil Rathbone Holmes.
Right.
And so for me, he is Holmes and will always be Holmes. And there are so many people who have no idea who he is because they've only seen the more recent versions of Holmes. So they think, you know, Jeremy Brett may be their Holmes. But what's amazing to me, and this I got out of the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, is for how many versions of Holmes there have been. And it actually started, the first film was in 1899.
No,
William Gillette's Sherlock Holmes, nominally co-authored by Conan Doyle, began its remarkable record of performances. And in 1900, Holmes made his debut on the screen in Sherlock Holmes Baffled, a 49-second long peep show. and then in 1905, Vitagraph made The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, shown in England as held for a ransom based loosely on the Sign of Four. But as he says, you know, scarcely a year has passed without Sherlock Holmes appearing on the screen somewhere in the world, even if only in the title. While well over 100 Sherlock Holmes films have been made, three actors dominate the public's vision of Holmes, and William Gillette apparently did it on the stage and later in silent film, Basil Rathbone, Jeremy Brett. And it is endlessly, you know, Holmes just goes on and on. And there's actually a new TV series, which is also based on Holmes. And there is a great book called The Story of the Men and Women Who Created an Icon from Holmes to Sherlock by Matthias Bostrom, which is basically an account of how everybody came to love Sherlock Holmes. And in one of the reviews of it, they write, if it's true that every generation needs a fresh translation of Homer, then it seems that every generation has also gotten its own Sherlock. As a creator of the beloved Benedict Cumberbatch Martin Freeman vehicle observed, to prove Holmes immortal, it's essential he's not preserved in Victorian aspic, but allowed to live again. So this book would be great for both fans of Holmes, but fans of film history, fans of literature, and a great addition to the very many, many books of Sherlockiana. And again, I still have to vote for Basil Rathbone. But
I think, you're of a certain age, Jill. We're right? And that's such a good point. It's the actor that you've come to know as Sherlock Holmes, it's really hard to let somebody else in on that space, right?
It's true. And I was first introduced to Sherlock Holmes in my sixth grade classroom because I had this amazing sixth grade teacher who after lunch would read us stories. And she read us The Speckled Band one day after lunch, which was it's an even more terrifying story than I realized in sixth grade. But anyway, she was the one. A shout out to Miss Caggiano, wherever she may be.
We are talking about film and TV adaptations of books with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Petra Mayer, editor at NPR Books. And we'd love to hear your suggestions. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about film and TV adaptations of books with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Petra Mayer, editor at NPR Books. 866-999-4626 is our phone number if you'd like to make a suggestion, or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And of course, as always, we will have a list later on today that we will put up on our website of all of the books and movies we talk about this morning. Let's talk to Denise, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Mindy. I love this show. I love all these book shows, but this one got me out of my seat right away. So I have two movies, one very old, one very new. I haven't seen the new one, that are based on books that I loved. And both of them chose as a film to open with a scene of violence that was not in the book. So the first one is Walkabout, if you remember that. In the book, the two kids are lost in the Australian outback after a plane crash in which everybody dies, and they are rescued by an Aborigine who is on his walkabout, and part of the walkabout is you are not to have any human contact, but he does because of these young children. Mm-hmm. So in the book, that's how the book started. In the film, they had the father take the children to the desert and start shooting at them to chase them away.
Oh, goodness.
Outrageous.
Yeah.
So my favorite book in the last several years has been The News of the World. And in the book, the young girl who was a captive is given to the man who reads the news by a freed black man because he knows he cannot travel with a little white girl to the south. So he asks the newsman to please take her. I understand that in the film, they've killed off the freedman, and how he gets the little girl. So if they've taken two books that really could be children's books, and my teenage grandchildren love The News of the World, and they've started them off with a scene of violence that I think is a real disservice to both of those books, both of those films. So that's my complaint today, and I'm looking forward to seeing
well,
the movie.
It's not just a complaint. You're actually recommending the books over the film. So we'll take it. Thanks for the call, Denise. Let's talk to Robin, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Mindy. So, Mike, I'm also liking books better than films. And my thing is that when they take a character and change their appearance, it's kind of annoying because I've visualized the character throughout, like, for example, Hermione, throughout the whole Harry Potter thing. I know what Hermione looked like. And then they make it Emma Watson, who is adorable, whereas Hermione is not supposed to be that gorgeous, you know, mm-hmm. and it really changes who Hermione is to have this cute little Emma Watson. And similarly, in Outlander, they had Jamie Frazier, who was sort of, in my mind anyway, and I've read these books so long ago, but the big hulking guy with red hair, and they make, again, a very attractive, smaller, more compact man with dark hair, who is very nice to look at, but isn't Jamie Frazier. So to me, that's like, I spend the whole time watching these things going, that's not what he looks like.
That's not them. Robin, thanks. And that's such a good point that Robin brings up, because that's one of the beauties about books, right? You paint this image in your brain of what these characters or scenes look like. That's a tough, I think, call maybe for people who are making these adaptations and, you know, what to keep and what to change.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I want to add to that because this is exactly what happened. I just read this article in The New Yorker about the Queen's Gambit. And the Queen's Gambit was, I thought, an amazing Netflix series. It was an original series based on a book called The Queen's Gambit by Walter Tevis. And the show itself, again, the TV version was absolutely riveting. And who would think that chess would be as fascinating as it was? Not me, I have to say, having never mastered the art of chess, although everybody apparently now wants to play chess because of the series. But there was this article in The New Yorker which talked about the article was actually called The Fatal Flaw of the Queen's Gambit by Sarah Miller. And she starts out by saying, I picked up Walter Tevis's novel, The Queen's Gambit, from 1983 at Skylight Books in Los Angeles sometime around 2002. It was a staff pick, and the blurb on the blue index card taped underneath said something like, Sleeper Gem by Dude Who Wrote The Man Who Fell to Earth, about an orphan chess prodigy addicted to downers. Read this now. On the cover, Michael Adonji, the author of The English Patient, said that he reread it every few years for the pure pleasure and skill of it. I read it in 2 days, and over the years, I've reread it probably a dozen times, from its first sentence, Beth learned of her mother's death from a woman with a clipboard, to its last. It was my platonic ideal of a novel. I loved its respect for the fact that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. Quote, from the back row, Beth put up her hand. It was the first time she had done this. And how this general efficiency made its richer emotional and physical details stand out, like brightly wrapped Christmas gifts set under a sparse tree. But when she went to read, when she watched the television series, she says that she couldn't watch it because in the book, Beth was not beautiful in any way. She was not considered beautiful. And in the film version, she is very beautiful. In fact, the actress playing her was at one point a model, apparently. So she has a great deal of trouble with this idea that you can totally change how a character looks when you are transferring it from book to film. And it was much what the last caller was saying about Outlander and Harry Potter and Hermione, that sometimes they just, whoever, for whatever reason, decides to radically change what the character looks like. And I think that's one of the hardest things about, because you always do imagine in your head what the characters look like. But when the author is really specific about what the character looks
like. Right. Then, you'd think you'd have to stick with that. Petra, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I had exactly the same problem with Hermione in the movies. So there's actually a word for that, right? It's called headcanon, like what the character looks like and acts like in your head. And everybody has their own headcanon for the books that they love. And, you know, I'm of two minds about it, because sometimes the tendency to insist on your own headcanon can get ugly. You know, the example that I'm thinking of is of how fans of the Hunger Games books reacted to the casting of Amanda Stenberg as Rue, who in the books, I could be remembering this wrong, but I don't think whether or not she's black is specified in the books, but the actress, of course, is black, and people were like, wait, that's not Rue. But so there's that, you know, there's the idea that like your headcanon is your headcanon, but that story is out in the world and you don't control it and you don't own it and you sort of need to accept how other people are interpreting it. But at the same time, also, like, there are instances of that where somebody's interpretation of a character on screen has indicated to me as a reader and a fan of the original property that whoever's making the adaptation so totally misunderstood what's going on with that character that it just drives me insane and I can't watch. So for me, that would have been the AMC adaptation of Preacher, which is a very violent mid-90s comic book that I dearly love, about a preacher who is sort of possessed by a supernatural entity that's half angel and half demon. It's very complicated. But his best friend in the series is a vampire named Cassidy, an Irish vampire. And in the series, in the comics originally, Cassidy, you never see his eyes. Because I'm going to spoil it a little bit. As the series goes along, Cassidy is revealed to be, under his bonhomie and like good guy Irish persona, to be really corrupt. And when you finally see his eyes, they embody his corruption. And when I was so excited for the AMC series, because I was like, oh my God, this is my favorite comic when I was in college. And the very first thing you see on screen is Cassidy without his sunglasses on. You see his eyes. And I didn't even realize that was him, because it's so canonical that he wears sunglasses all the time and you don't see his eyes until it's very important dramatically for the plot. So I just, my nerd rage registered on the Richter scale, and I think I watched like one more episode and then rage quit. Like, I was just like, I don't understand this character or this story.
Yeah.
So it's complicated. Yeah. Like, I understand the need to see your headcanon on screen and to and to know that whoever is adapting the book understands it, but there's also the idea that, you know, you don't control this story, you don't own it, and and seeing what other people do with it can actually be expanding and interesting. Like, oh, I didn't think of that character that way, but yeah, it totally could be.
Yeah.
So I'm on the question.
Yeah, Robin, thanks for the phone call. We have Sharon calling from Mashpee. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Mindy. Yeah, I just have two that might not be very mysterious, but they are mysteries. Murdoch Mysteries and Midsummer Murders. I love Murdoch Mysteries, I guess mainly because it takes place in Canada. And my grandmother came over from Cork, Ireland, and landed in Canada, and then went down to Minneapolis and married my grandfather. But I just love the characters in Murdoch Mysteries, and I just want to see where my grandmother was, you know, with all that in the early 1900s. Anyway, those two, I just love them, and you know, that's all.
Great. No, thanks for sharing that, Sharon. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Edwina writes, in the Lee Child book, Jack Reacher is supposed to be 6'5" tall and 250 pounds. Tom Cruise is about half the size, and in no way could he do what Reacher is supposed to do in the action scenes.
Me too.
What a disappointment. Thanks for your show.
That
was
really
a good point to point out. Yeah. And then Tim writes, many decades ago in the 20s and 30s, there was an opposite dynamic in the same space. A movie was made and then adapted to novel form with stills from the movie as illustrations. I came upon this when I found a copy of the original Wolf of Wall Street, which was a Depression era, an American Tragedy type of noir story. Have any other listeners encountered this? 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Petra, what's next on your list?
Well, I actually wanted to rewind a second.
Sure.
Because we were talking about Sherlock Holmes and all the various interpretations of him. And this just occurred to me. It wasn't one of the things I was prepared for. But when I was thinking about books that I wanted to see adapted to the screen, I thought about Sherry Thomas's Lady Sherlock books. Because there are a lot of people out there sort of doing not exactly gender swapped, but like, what would a woman be like in this environment kind of approach to Sherlock Holmes. And I realized it's kind of already been done with Enola Holmes, but it made me think of a series that I loved a million years ago and really wish would be adapted, the Holmes and Russell books by Laurie R. King. They are about a young American sort of blue stocking who comes to England and makes friends with Sherlock Holmes and becomes sort of involved in his life, and eventually they get married later on in the series. But she is so smart, and Laurie R. King, the author, manages to sort of replicate the cadences and the world building of Sherlock Holmes. It's almost seamless, sort of the continuation. So the first book in that series is called The Beekeeper's Apprentice. So if you're looking for a really interesting, fresh take on Sherlock Holmes, I really recommend those books. They're great. So hang on, I have to go back and look at my notes because I prepared a whole bunch of stuff. I know what I wanted to talk about, because we've talked about Bridgerton, and I've thought about sort of adaptations of romance on screen, and I wanted to talk about a really just charming movie called To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is on Netflix. It's an adaptation of a YA novel by an author named Jenny Han. And the idea is there's a 16-year-old girl, and she loves to read romance novels and dream about love and dating, but she's scared completely bleepless about the actual thing. So what she does is she writes these beautiful love letters to all the guys she's ever had crushes on, and then she addresses them, and then she saves them in a box in her closet. And of course, her little sister gets the box and mails out all the letters, and then all hell breaks loose. And it's just, it's charming, and it's gentle, and it's comforting, and it kind of has the quality that I look for in romance, which is that you think the story is going to go the lazy route, you know, with the big misunderstanding or the really common trope or something equally dumb that, like, breaks up the couple in the third act. And it kind of sort of happens. But then everyone is very mature, and they talk things out in a way that, you know, makes you wish you'd been that cool as a teenager. Certainly none of the guys I ever knew at that age were as chill and self-aware as some of the guys Lara Jean, the main character, has crushes on. But that's To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is an adaptation of a YA novel. And it is, it's just, it right now it's perfect. It's just like slipping into a hot bath, which is actually an important moment in the movie. That's why I chose that simile.
All right, Jill.
Well, one of the things I've also been thinking about as we put this show together was all the books that have not been made into films for mysterious reasons. I have no idea why, and some of them I think they've tried and they haven't succeeded, but I really, really would love to see a film, what I'd love to see is a miniseries, a TV series of the book Islandia, which is a novel by Austin Tappan Wright. This is an old book. This book came out originally in 1942. The narrator is this fellow named John Lang, and he's studying at Harvard in 1901, and as it is described in an article by Charles Finch, who wrote this great article about this novel, which I just recently discovered. He says, at a beer night, he meets a fellow undergraduate named Dorn, athletic and intelligent, curiously indifferent to social norms. He is from Islandia, a country we soon learn that people know little about. Americans tend to think of it as an agricultural nation, Lang will later explain, remotely situated, but lacking the interest and color of China and Japan. And some of the things about Islandia, the place, and John Lang goes down, ends up going to Islandia, and he reports back on it, and he's saying, and this I think is just so resonant right now for where we all are in the country. He reports back saying, no theaters or concerts, no baseball or football games, no tennis, no clubs, no shop fronts or bright-hued advertisements, no sense of swift journeys possible, no large dances, no restaurants. So, you know, he's sort of living in this, and he's finding this a wonderful, delightful change from his life in Cambridge and Harvard. And I was first introduced to this book by a friend of mine very, very long ago, and I was asking him about it last night, and he said I told him about this article that Charles Finch had written. And by the way, Charles Finch also writes a great series of mysteries, and those should really be turned into a series. The Charles Lennox Mysteries would make an incredible series, and I hope somebody does that at some point. But in any case, I talked to this friend, and he's saying, he read Charles's article, and Charles says he's had just recently reread Islandia. And my friend's answer to that was, only a second reread? I've probably reread it 10 times. And he also said something really interesting about this idea of wanting to make something into film. And he said, I don't wonder about how to portray the Islandia characters. They just exist for me. And I thought that was a really interesting way that if you love a book so much that you really don't want anyone to take away how you see it in your head. And one of the great things about Islandia is there also you learn this whole new language because there is a language that is just Islandian. And I had at one point started writing down all of the various little things that they say in Islandia. And it's about love, it's about cultures, it's about how cultures work. But here's a little some tidbits from Islandia. What good is love unsatisfied? Don't you feel that the love is good? Oh, you do. What is painful is its frustration. The love is always good, and it is better still if the one you love is worth loving. There are lots of different words that they use within the novel, which are you come to really enjoy, and I can't recommend this book enough, and it's quite lengthy, but you really get drawn in. And one of the funniest things about the book is that has to do with the library is that I actually met somebody in our book group. I was for some reason talking about Islandia, and she said to me, "Oh, my husband's name is Dorn," and I was like, "Oh my gosh, your husband's name is Dorn." Well, Dorn is one of the lead characters in Islandia, and he's a wonderful character. But what was funny was that her husband had actually never read the book, but his mother had. And his mother so fell in love with the story that she decided to name him Dorn. So why this hasn't been made into a long miniseries, I don't know. But it is a beautiful work of literature, and it is a great book to fall into and thus end up in another country that doesn't really exist.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books that have been turned into films or our TV adaptations with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Petra Mayer, editor at NPR Books. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Anita writes, "As a dog lover, I always take note of any prominent dog book character and have noticed, having watched all the Jane Eyre renditions, almost all dog castings miss the mark by casting a Great Dane or a Labrador Retriever or Spanish Mix or Irish Wolfhound when the book's description reads, 'Gilded a great dog whose black and white color made him a distinct object against the trees.' It was exactly one form of Bessie Skytras, a lion-like creature with long hair and a huge head. Annie's 1997 version got it right with its black and white Landseer Newfoundland." Thanks for that, Anita. We have Rich calling from Yarmouthport. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. You've been talking a lot about mysteries, and I love mysteries. And you also mentioned my favorite author, P.G. Wodehouse. But I wanted to speak a little bit about science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Or I guess you'd call it science fiction. The two adaptations of 1984, way back in 56 with Edmund O'Brien, and then in 84 with John Hurt. I introduced my children to Orwell from the 56 version of I made him sit and watch the Edmund O'Brien film version. And the 1954 animated Animal Farm, which I think needs to be shown again.
Right.
Animal Farm is Orwell did some things in both of those books that are really timeless, in my opinion.
Right. Rich, yeah. Good points then. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was also, then I was looking at Heinlein, Starship Troopers. I was a bit disappointed, to say the least. But I thought of a Heinlein book that I think kind of almost cries out for a possible film right now, and it's his book Friday. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not.
Well, Petra, you're our science fiction person. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
Can you say the title again? Unfortunately, with perfect timing, the neighbor's yard guys have shown up, and they're incredibly loud. They blow right outside my window.
Heinlein wrote a book called Friday.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
She is a woman who is actually an artificial creation. And it deals with, she has enhanced physical abilities because of that. She was designed to work for spy agencies, and in the course of it talks about how artificial people are discriminated against and prejudiced against, and how she is trying to fit into society and hide her abilities. And I can see a number of our present day actresses who could probably do a wonderful job in a film adaptation of it.
Well, I think
that's amazing.
Yeah.
I would like to see it. I will say, you know what? I've never watched any of the adaptations of 1984 because it's my favorite book in the whole world. And as we discussed earlier about headcanon, I just don't want to see anybody else's vision on screen because it means so much to me, and I have it constructed in my head in a very specific way.
Yeah. Rich, thanks for those suggestions. Those are all good ones. Thanks for the call. Appreciate that. And we'll keep our eyes open. Maybe somebody will hear you and make that adaptation from Hyland's book. We'll see. All right, let's talk to Tor, who's calling from Falmouth. Good morning.
Good morning. Love the subject. A couple of points. One, I talked about a lot of classic books, and I admit I haven't read a lot of those, but books that are popular. I'm thinking of John Irving, which I enjoy the books, but I'm always reluctant to see a movie of a book that I've enjoyed. And the one John Irving that I thought that I did think was very well done was A World According to Garp. So I was nervous going to see it, and I said, oh, phew, they did it well. And another comment, I find foreign movie versions of books that I like better than American versions of the same thing. I find with a foreign production, I'm not distracted by a familiar American actor, so I can enjoy the story a lot more in the book. I'm thinking of A Man Called Ovi by Friedrich Bachmann, and the foreign one was much better. I liked it much better than the American. I can sit back and I don't have preconceptions of what I'm expecting from that particular, you know, familiar American face.
Yeah, good point. Thanks for the call, Tor. We had another caller, Jill and Petra, who wanted to know your thoughts on adaptations of Agatha Christie mysteries.
Well, I'm going to defer to Jill here.
That's funny. I was thinking of Agatha Christie, and I have to say, there are a lot of films that I have liked. I haven't so much liked the series, although people very much love some of the series that have been done. But and I'm trying to think, some of the classic films I particularly like. And Poirot is another one of whom there are lots of different versions. And I love the PBS series of Poirot.
David Sachet, yeah, David. It's got to be David Sachet.
Right,
he's the best Poirot ever.
Right.
Yeah,
like how once you see him as Poirot, it's like, yes, that's him.
That's him.
There's no doubt in my mind that's who he is. I think again, it's like with all of these, you choose the ones that somehow speak to you, and or you see them at a particular time. You see the film, or you read the film. You know, whether you read the film book first or see the film, it makes a big difference. And actually, the science fiction guy that was just talking, I wanted to mention Jack Finney's book called The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which has been made into, I have only seen one version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which terrified me so much I never again needed to see another version of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But I thought, oh, for this show, I'll read the book because I'd never read his book. And Jack Finney actually, and the book was actually quite interesting, and begins, I warn you that what you're starting to read is full of loose ends and unanswered questions. It will not be neatly tied up at the end, everything resolved and satisfactorily explained. Not by me, it won't anyway, because I can't say I really know exactly what happened or why or just how it began, how it ended, or if it has ended, and I've been right in the thick of it. Now, if you don't like that kind of story, I'm sorry, and you'd better not read it. All I can do is tell what I know. And this, for those of you that might not know the Body Snatchers, is that these pods have sort of taken over the town, and so you see people all look like themselves,
but
there's something wrong about them, and the people closest to them know that they are not the actual people that they appear to be. And the whole, oh my gosh, the novel is as terrifying as the film.
Yeah. We have an email about, it says, in the first book of the series of The Hunger Games, Rue is described, she had bright, dark eyes and satiny brown skin. She says Rue was perfectly cast in the movie. So
You're right. I misremembered it. I did remember that there was a controversy over the casting, but I didn't remember what she was originally like in the book because I read it so long ago. So thank you, reader, for correcting
me.
I knew somebody would, and I appreciate it.
All right, Petra, what have you got next?
Well, I was thinking about things that I would like to see adapted, and it's interesting. Like, right now is a great time to be a sci-fi and fantasy fan for TV possibilities, because I think what I think it is everybody's trying to find the next Game of Thrones, you know, the next big epic sci-fi series. So, like, when I was trying to think of things that I wanted to see adapted, almost everything that I looked up is already in development somewhere.
Wow.
Yeah, like N.K. Jemisin, who I may have talked about on this show before, she won 3 Hugos in a row. That's basically the Oscars of sci-fi for her Broken Earth trilogy, which is this amazing, powerful series about sort of a world which may be a far future Earth, you're not quite sure, but it's constantly racked by these geological disturbances that create atmospheric disturbances that are called seasons. The first book is called The Fifth Season. And they just cause these upheavals that can last for almost thousands of years. And the only people in this world who can control the geological eruptions are called, I'm not even sure, this is a word I've only ever seen written and never pronounced, so orogenes. And they are despised. They're deeply necessary to society, but they're despised and outcast and exploited. So it's an incredibly, if you want to sort of be punched in the face with your complicity and systems of oppression, but also really enjoy the experience, this is a great thing. And it's being adapted. She's got a TV deal. Leigh Bardugo's Grishaverse books, which are this amazing series sort of rooted slightly in Russian mythology, but there's a great, one of them is a great heist caper called Six of Crows. That's got a TV deal. Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea books, I think, are being adapted. Nnedi Okorafor's Who Fears Death. Even The Wheel of Time, which is this endless series that I can't in good conscience recommend, but I deeply love. That's being made, I think, for Amazon right now. So, like, it's such a good time right now for fantasy and sci-fi on TV. That being said, I think what I'd love to see on TV maybe would be Shauna Ann McGuire's October Day series, which is this series about a half-fairy, half-human private investigator slash knight-errant in San Francisco and all of her adventures. That I don't think has a TV deal yet, but it really should because it's a fantastic
Story. Maybe. You never know. And you know, we only have about a minute and a half left, but you mentioned Game of Thrones, and I know it was hugely popular. I watched the first episode, and I was so horrified when they pushed that little boy out the window to his supposed death, which I understand he doesn't die. I couldn't watch another one. I was like, oh my gosh, if this is what this is going to be like, I can't watch this kind of a series. Should I give it another shot?
No.
No. Okay. All right. I was right in ending it there. Okay, good. That's good to know. Again, we'll have a list of all the books and movies and films that we talked about in TV adaptations on our list on our website a little bit later today, capeandislands.org. Petra Mayer, editor at NPR Books, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Thank you both for being with us this
morning.
Thank
you, Mindy.
Appreciate your time.
So much fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.